It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Amazon's second headquarters will be in Austin, Texas, if you believe the peacock theory cooked up by Texas Monthly Magazine. Okay, so 3 weeks ago, Amazon ran a Super Bowl ad in which Alexa loses her voice.
In Austin, it's 60 degrees with a...
Did you hear what she was saying when she lost her voice? The weather forecast in Austin, Texas. And Austin happens to be on Amazon's list of finalists for its second headquarters. So that was hint number one. Then in the same Super Bowl ad, a man asks his Amazon device this.
Alexa, play some country music.
Play some country music. Okay, there's country music in Austin, Texas. So those were the obvious hints. But I didn't catch the third hint in that Super Bowl ad. It shows the actor Anthony Hopkins feeding a bird.
I'm afraid Brandon is a little tied up.
But do let me know if there's anything I can help you with.
Anthony Hopkins is feeding a peacock. And guess where a lot of peacocks live?
They just always have lived here. And everybody knows that who lives here.
They're like an Austin institution.
They're like an Austin institution. In fact, there are so many peacocks there that the city of Austin put up school crosswalk signs in neighborhoods where there are no schools.
Children crossing sign, and I guess that's because the city doesn't have a peacock crossing sign.
Yeah, well, here's another sign Austin might need soon. Amazon crossing. Effects on city may be larger than they appear. It's The Record. We'll be right back. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for listening to The Record. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Millennials are selfish and entitled, says Time magazine. The New York Post says millennials need to put away the juice boxes and grow up. My next guest says that cliche misses the bigger point, that when it comes to the important stuff, millennials have been more neglected than coddled. Author and filmmaker Sean Scott has written the new book, Millennials and the Moments That Made Us. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you.
May I offer you a juice box?
I've got some tea here.
You do? Okay.
So I think I'm going to be good.
You're good.
Unless you guys have high C or Capri Sun, then I might have to take
Sunny D. First of all, Sean, in your own house, you had three generations. You had boomer parents, you had Gen X siblings, and you. How did your parents treat you differently from your Gen X elders, if at all?
You know, I think it's kind of a thing where a lot of... baby boomers sort of felt like maybe they had been a little bit too permissive with Generation X.
Mm-hmm.
The schools had gotten too lax. Maybe Generation X was just sort of written off both societally as sort of a lost generation. And I think there's also sort of a sense in a familial way that you get a second chance with millennials. You get the chance to return, you know, to go back to basics.
I should say the Gen X is my generation, arguably. Right. I'm sort of near the boomer cusp,
right.
but I remember we were the latchkey kids.
Right,
we
right. And we were too. I mean, that's something that I think millennials and Generation X have in common. I think the difference is that the latchkey entertainment started to become a lot more martial, I want to say, in the way that you had this whole sort of culture of fear that I remember pretty vividly with like Dare, you know, Dare to Keep Kids Off Drugs and McGruff the Crime Dog.
Oh, yes.
All these sort of just ways that it became clear that there was kind of like a culture of overprotection that surrounded a lot of millennials. And I remember that a lot, too. Like, back to basics is a phrase that I almost feel like I get like PTSD when I hear those words because I think about, you know, sort of having to drill down and do like doing long division was like a test of character. It wasn't just can you solve this math problem, it's like can you win the obstacle course. And uh-huh. I think that's kind of the reality that's facing a lot of millennials still. In one way or another, we're still sort of hopping through certain hurdles and not necessarily knowing why they have to be there in the first place.
Well, your parents were going to pay more attention to you than to the Beavis and Butthead generation,
right?
That I was in, right? Was that the idea?
Right, yeah. And I mean, Beavis and Butthead was great because I remember watching that show a lot. And my parents, who were Jamaican immigrants, mostly just kind of thinking it was nonsense. And so if you're gonna look at that, we're not even gonna take you seriously right now. But most parents didn't really have that attitude, right? I tell the story in the fifth chapter of my book about how there was a kid, I think it was in Florida, who like burned down his trailer because Beavis is always saying fire, fire. And so at one point in time, this kid gets the inspiration to burn down his house literally. And it actually literally forces MTV to take down the 7 p.m. airing of Beavis and Butthead because they figured out that's when the most unattended kids were watching the show. So they pushed it an hour later. And that's just kind of one of many examples that I try to highlight in my book about how rather than actually sort of giving families and people the resources that they needed to spend more time at home, rather than pursuing paternal and maternal leave, rather than having universal health care, rather than having all these social programs that would make it so that people could spend more time with their kids and not worry about lapsing into poverty or sliding even deeper into it, in the 90s, we sort of had this culture war spectacle where we were paying more attention to Beavis than we were to, you know, the social safety net.
And is that because, well, America was never that broadly socially progressive? Or was there some other reason why parents seem to focus more on the, I don't know, the symptoms, the low-hanging fruit than actual systemic change?
Right, yeah. And I think it's definitely the case that we sort of culturally have taken a, we took a turn, I think, at a certain point in time. We made a million different cultural transactions that just put us more in a place where if somebody is struggling or they need help, we're looking at that more as a mark of personal deficiency than as a collective problem. The most unequal, I don't want to say the equal period in American life, but the most unequal, or the most equal period in American life, excuse me, was that period that ran from, say, post-World War II until the middle 1970s, where we sort of said questions like poverty, like civil rights, like access to healthcare, those are collective decisions that we need to have a functioning legislative framework to address. That gradually sort of got chipped away, I think, as we made the transition into the 1980s, and that's where you start to see much more sort of a sense of if you're having an issue with it, it must be something that's wrong with you. And that's how I think a lot of young people who have never really known, a lot of millennials in particular who have never really known anything but that cultural climate tend to look at and think about social problems. But I also think as we've aged, we've made a transition out of that. Like you look at the one of the reasons why so many people were excited, so many millennials were excited by Barack's campaigns, by Bernie Sanders' campaigns, is it's sort of the sense that we can actually do something to muster collective will to address social problems.
Would you say that America needs a 1960s style, kind of like a reckoning with income inequality of the kind where we grappled with systemic racism?
Right. I mean, there are people who are in the Ku Klux Klan who will get defensive when you call them a racist and say, I'm not a racist. There are like skinheads that have swastikas tattooed onto their bodies who say, I'm not a racist, right? So we had, at one point in time, we had a collective referendum on race relations in this country to such an extent that people that are on such an obvious side of the racial divide don't want to be called out for intensifying that divide in such a way that we've never had a similar conversation like that en masse, I feel, about class and structural inequality. So that I want to live in a world where Jeff Bezos says, I'm not a capitalist as he's on his way to the bank, right? Like, I want to live in a world where somebody like Warren Buffett, even if they're going to sit there and hoard a bunch of money, at least culturally, we need to get to the stage where we recognize wealth inequality as a problem, as opposed to, you know, most Americans thinking of themselves as temporarily embarrassed millionaires, right? And if only they get the breaks that enable them to make it into that millionaire class, that's when maybe they'll start being able to recognize class is more of an issue. I think that's kind of the stage that we're at now, where we need to have that kind of a frank conversation about wealth inequality being a big problem.
Yeah. So when it comes to race, white Americans cleaved off, made two different definitions of racism. So there was still the systemic racism, but the kind of attitudinal,
right,
you know, well, but I'm a nice person,
right,
got separated.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what would that look like with income inequality? We'll still have it, but it won't but people will wring their hands over it.
Right, right. Or you sort of get to a stage now where, I mean, maybe the corner has turned a little bit, not enough, but I think there is a general sense of self-awareness that people who maintain a lot of privilege have in, you know, maybe spending a lot of money on clothes that make them look poorer than they actually are, mm-hmm. or having a house that's, you know, maybe 10,000 square feet smaller than it would have been if they were just going all in like people did in the 1980s with, you know, lifestyles of the rich and famous. But I think that the great thing about having a frank conversation about class and about structural inequality is that you figure out pretty quickly who the posers are versus who the protagonists are in that sort of narrative and trying to get to a more equal place societally.
Well, Seattle has been one of those places where it's not cool to flaunt wealth.
Right.
But has that made Seattle any less unequal as it's turned out?
It really hasn't. I mean, and I'm sure there are a lot of housing activists that would be surprised to hear that it's not cool to flaunt wealth, because at every, you know, city hearing that you go to where we're trying to advocate for more affordable housing, it's very, very clear who the folks who have you know, proto mansions and neighborhoods that are not too far from here, maybe in Wallingford, maybe out in Magnolia or elsewhere, who are actually pretty unapologetic about wanting to hold on to and maintain what I think is a pretty clear vestige of class and race disprivilege in the form of a lot of single family homes. Seattle is kind of one of those places where the branding is very, very strong. And I think those of us who have maybe been on certain sides of activist battles here know the reality from the representation.
Well, then what would you say to a baby boomer or a Gen Xer who's out of work in some Rust Belt town who says, I wish I were a millennial. I wish I were a digital native who has a better shot at the jobs of the future.
Right. And that's where I say that ultimately, what I try to do in my book and in a lot of conversations that we have about millennials is really use generational politics as a proxy for talking about a lot of these larger questions, and that there are as many millennials who are part of the 3-5% of millennials locally that Zillow identified in a 2015 study as being as having a median income above $300,000. As there are many millennials that fit into that mold, as there are many baby boomers that are struggling seniors that might be vulnerable homeowners who maybe got bamboozled in the during the Great Recession with a predatory loan. Many baby boomers who might not be naturalized citizens, as it turns out. And so these conversations about disprivilege, I think I use generational politics as kind of a poison pill to have a lot of these larger kinds of conversations. And hopefully, when people read the book or when they listen to the show, they don't think that I'm out here trying to say that, you know, all millennials have a halo on their heads. And if you're a baby boomer, the best that you can do is just kind of fork over the debit card.
That book, by the way, is Millennials and the Moments That Made Us. And it's written by author and filmmaker Sean Scott. And did I understand it right, Sean, that you've argued that it would help if we approached social problems the way we do sports?
Did I say that?
Or did I mangle that?
No. I'm gonna try to own it.
Okay.
I think I'm a huge Seahawks fan. I was a fan of the Sonics when we had a team. I've disowned the Mariners, but that's a separate conversation. And I noticed like sort of the passion that fans take to sort of more peripheral cultural concerns like sports or maybe like reality TV, and just the massive investment in time and energy that it takes to be an up-to-date fan. And you think, you know, I sometimes grow reflective. It's like, man, you know, could you take this down by even 25%? I think I'd probably be a lot more knowledgeable about local politics or even about national politics. And so it's kind of a constant reminder that a lot of the cultural pursuits that I talk about in my book, I try to link those as quickly as possible to politics so that we're not sort of lost in the maze of symbols and signs, and we're working our way back over to substance.
Mm. So we need a state legislative fantasy draft.
I think so. Well, there's going to be a lot of them. I was listening to the public records request segment that you did. I think there's a lot of House Democrats that a lot of people did a lot of work for that probably couldn't get drafted by a lot of people who are pretty mad at what they went and did, making life harder on on journalists and radio show hosts like you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, I laughed when I saw this idea of that a sports approach was helpful, because I think of sports as being the, you could call it harmless tribalism, but the ultimate kind of partisanship and tribalism, win, lose,
right.
You know, I hate 49er fans or right. whatever. I thought, really? Sean wants more of a sports attitude in public life than there already is?
Right. Yeah. I mean, look, I think we should nationalize the Seahawks. Is that such a big deal? I think there's a pretty frank conversation that we need to be having about sort of sports as people using that as sort of like a substitute for a federal commitment to maybe providing more jobs or other kinds of federal commitments or even municipal commitments that we could be making with collective will. We tend to think that, you know, sports will provide the jobs, sports will come on in and spur business at local restaurants and shops and things like that. And that those are really a function of kind of declining civic identity that people have used to have in an earlier sort of era, now sort of redirected into avenues that can actually end up hurting cities in pretty calculable ways. You know?
Sean Scott's book is Millennials and the Moments That Made Us. And you dropped something earlier that you said that you're the child of Jamaican immigrants.
Right.
What is the generation conversation, millennials, Gen X, baby boomers, what's the Jamaican version of that? Have your parents ever talked to you about that?
Well, like a lot of sort of post-colonial subjects, it's interesting because my parents never really knew in Jamaica anyway, and a lot of people who you could talk to who are maybe from Venezuela or who are from India, those were countries that actually for a decade or so had a pretty in-depth socialist experiment. And so that generation that are nominally baby boomers that migrated here never really had the opportunity to sort of push back on the sort of the entrenchment of Reaganomics that we saw in the 1980s or 90s. And so many of them civically without the right to vote were sort of in a position where they might not have agreed with the direction that the country was heading in, but they had to internalize a lot of those values and internalize a lot of the values that seemed to rise to the fore in the 1980s, to the point where I've noticed a kind of a cognitive dissonance among many sort of immigrant baby boomers or baby boomers who came here maybe in the 70s or 80s, where on the one hand, they can't stand Trump. They can't stand to see him on the television. But a lot of the same lessons about how we were supposed to make it as millennials were very much in that kind of mold, right? If you're struggling, it's something that you personally need to work harder. Maybe getting a bad grade is a sign of personal weakness as opposed to a school that maybe needs more funding. And all that to say nothing of the conversation about mental health awareness that I think was exacerbated and intensified in the home in relationships between millennials and baby boomers. But I do think there's sort of a coming back together and an unstated maybe sense that I've sort of noticed in my dad, who supported Bernie when he ran in 2016, that maybe sort of the governing logic of how things worked out for the previous 30 years was trash on one level or another, and we need to take that out and go in a different direction. So,
was your dad an ex-Republican who went Bernie Sanders?
No. I don't want to come on NPR and slander my parents. You know, no. I think if my dad had the chance, he would have voted against Reagan early and often. He couldn't stand Bill Clinton even when he was in there. And so I think I came out on the, I got lucky. I think, yeah. I got lucky.
That's millennial Sean Scott. You're millennials. What year are we using these days?
It's a good question. It shifts a lot. I mean, the functional definition that I use in my book and the subtitle of the book is A Cultural History of the U.S. from 1982 to the present. And I use 1982 because the social theorist that came up with the term, Neil Howe and William Strauss, that's the date, that's the cutoff point that they use. Mm. If you ask Pew Research Center, I think they say it's 1981 to 1997. Others have used, have argued for sort of like a liminal generation between Generation X and Millennials, cleverly titled Xennials, between 1980, 1977 and 1983. I decide on 1982, but I think it becomes pretty clear through the course of my book that we're really talking about large-scale shifts, and you can draw the boundary a year here or a year there, but it really is not going to make too big of a difference as far as what somebody born in that general era may have experienced.
Sean Scott qualifies to write the new book, Millennials and the Moments That Made Us. Good to see you again, Sean. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me on.